The Off The Ball Podcast Network.
Okay, we are here with our friends Heineken. They are worldwide sponsors of Japan 2019. And as part of these road shows, they've made the suggestion, which we think is a good one to get on, an unexpected guest. And our unexpected guest this evening, you have no idea who he is. But would you give him a warm welcome? I mean, he's had a phenomenal career in so many ways. He's an uber-talented man. He's very happy. Tipperary have won the All-Ireland. Give him a warm welcome. Pat Jord, everyone!
Oh, what a lovely audience.
I know this is going out on radio. He looks a lot like John Kenny, isn't he?
The spit of him.
The spit of him.
Yeah.
Pat, how are you doing? You're very well.
Good, thank you, yeah.
We were just chatting a few minutes earlier off air. Some people may have heard the conversation, some may not. So you were saying, I mean, hurling, Tipperary man, very happy, but you've come to love rugby the more you live in Limerick. Is that the general gist?
Well, that's the gist of it, yeah. You can't avoid it. And it's great. I mean, it is everywhere. And it is, going into Thomond Park, I was lucky enough to go there back in the early days of it, not as early as 70-something, whatever it is. But, before they did it all up and everything else, and there's no doubt about it, there's an atmosphere out there. It's just electric and amazing to watch any club or team playing there. And since they've done it up the same, you know, yeah. So it's been great.
Does a party you prefer that old ground and the old atmosphere, those 90s days?
Yeah, it was good. You can get a beer in there now and you can drink away if you're in the right spot and a good onion sandwich.
Pat was very important for us. He was part of the, I know there's a bit of a talk about project players and stuff like that, but he was part of the integration module for the Irish rugby team if we had any guys that weren't from the shores. We brought them to the Dumbelievables show in 1993. And one of the great joys was watching Paddy Johns being dragged up onto the stage by John Kenny and made into a total Egypt.
Like people think that we know who we're picking up and everything else. And genuinely, John is a fanatical Munster fan and rugby fan. And when you go down after, I was saying to Keith, when you get off the stage and you're going through the audience, you just have in your head, I'm down off the stage this length of time, I need to get someone quick, I need to get someone because the show's kind of pacing, timing, and you're looking for a friendly face that might go with you and the whole lot. And I remember I was on the stage or side of stage, and John grabbed Paddy John, and the minute he sat up, he was an enormous, huge man. And I said, he's definitely a rugby player. He has to be. And John, even though John knew him, he had no idea who he grabbed. And got him up onto the stage, but the rest of the team were down there, and they just all erupted.
Yeah, it was kind of part of it, and it became the video that they had. Was that 93, 94?
Yeah,
but it became the video to show the players, you know, some of the exiles. We had a New Zealand player. This is what it is to be Irish. Yeah. These are the people that we were brought up on, which was a good part of our rugby.
Yeah, and it worked both ways. I remember when we were doing Kilnascully, we have a big crew from all over the country down, and some of the guys, one of the guys that played schools with Leinster, and he was mad for us to play rugby like after the shoot in the evening time, tag rugby or something. So it was the crew against the cast, and I put together a couple of the cast members, and we got destroyed the first night. So the following week, they played, they said, you can pick whoever you want, you know. So I rang Rob Henderson, who was living down the road from me. And I had four Lions players on my team then. And that is true.
I have a video of you in action, by the way.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I think that's my fault.
Rugby referee. This is a charity game. So they said, who will we get to ref the game? And they went for you, which was a hell of a choice. We can roll it there.
Colette.
This is better than the sound.
You haven't changed. You haven't changed the pitch.
You can see I beefed up for that role there.
I'll tell you, I thought
he wanted me a prop.
That was for the launch of Claridge's Park, and Anthony Foley and I were the two captains.
That's right, yeah.
And you came out wired for it. You were fitter than a couple of the Pro 14 referees, were you?
But it's amazing how people took the game very serious. One guy was taken out.
Yeah.
It's a charity game, and you ran over to his pack, get in there. So I put up a yellow card, and I got given out to.
You sent me off as well, by the way.
Which I
still hold against you. But it was
a good day.
It was a brilliant day. It was a community park we had in Killaloe, and it was 3 or 4 weeks before Anthony passed away.
Oh, yeah.
And But it was, you know, we said, look, we wanted to do something a bit different. So we'd soccer in one half, yeah. and then we'd touch rugby in the second half. And we said, okay, this is going to be a total farce. So let's bring Pat Short.
To make it a disaster.
And it was actually carnage. It was fantastic. There was 2,000 people turned up to watch us be total Egypts. Actually, they all turned up to watch you. By the way, I don't know if you could see it there. He had a pair of wellies on as well. Very fetching.
You mentioned the Dunbelievables there. When that was at its high point, when that was humming and you and John were in perfect sync, you know, can you give us a sense of why it was so good, why it worked, what was going on with you two? Because there's a magic about it.
Yeah, I it's hard to know. I mean, I think we both were on the same wavelength. We were doing something that was, one critic, indigenously Irish is what he called us, you know what I mean? Being both musicians, and we lived in each other's ear. We were, you know, that's a large part of it. We were very good friends, still are, but we were very close at the time. We lived... tour, we slept in the back of the van, you know what I mean, when we were starting out. And I think that bond, it's hard to kind of, to try and make that up. That's something that's organic and grows in time. So we started kind of, the whole thing, I started working as a sound engineer with John for about 4 years and then gradually started playing music and getting up on the stage with him and having the crack. And we just talked about our comedy was about very ordinary things that were happening in rural Ireland. There weren't, you know, and there was that kind of thinking, a bit like, why is Coronation Street the biggest TV soap in the world? It's only about a small community in Manchester, you know. So the small thing is global in lots of ways, and that's kind of how we approached it. We didn't try to write or create or go with any comic trends at the time. We just did what we did and hoped people liked it, and it did. It captured the imagination of everyone in Ireland at the time and abroad, you know.
And abroad, as well. Is there a high point or is there a memory where you thought, oh my God, we have made the big time?
We used to never think like that. We'd always try and get out the back door and get to the pub for the pint. You know, I mean, we played the Barbican in London. We sold out there. We played in New York, across the Midwest. We did mad TV shows and stuff. We played all over down in Zambia, Zimbabwe. And we kind of did mad gigs and in crazy places, but it's kind of hard to pinpoint one particular moment that was exceptional, you know. There was loads of great moments, you know, like playing great gigs and sell-out houses, but we were known for getting out backstage, getting out of costume as quick as possible and running across the road to the pub for a pint, you know.
How would you find a character? Like, we see it in Killing a Scully as well. Like, how do you find one, or who's a favourite character that you can give us a blast of now, or how you find that character?
God, I don't know. I think you just... It's a mix of things. Any character you do is a mix of five different people maybe that have influenced you or something. Yeah. It's never that one. I used to love the teacher character.
How did that go?
I hate you with a passion.
I'm sorry,
right now.
Sorry.
You know, I know. I mean, like, it's hard. You see, but they're visual. They build up. You know, he was like, his thing was Darcy throwing a fella out. It was a mix of a whole load of different things. Yeah. You know what I mean? We often, Seth and John, you say, if you read through our scripts, they're not the funniest thing at all. You know,
is that right?
It's how you performed them and played them out.
Yeah.
But I would have still felt that was kind of what it was like growing up in rural Ireland. We all knew the hurling coach.
Yes.
We all knew the teacher who would give you all that sort of gowling around, you know, because you were messing in the back of it. And it was comfortable.
Yeah.
And ludicrously funny, because we were all 20 years older or 10 years older from it. You know, it's kind of a hearkening back to early days.
Yeah, and simple, even like That's Riot. You know, it's an interesting, that catchphrase, it stuck with me and still is today, but that came about from a commercial we did for the Lotto, which only ran for 7 weeks on the television, where Butty and Roundy were the two characters we created, and there was so much information. The Lotto was raising the price by 50p at the time, and they wanted a big campaign. So John's character would go, is it true there isn't the Lotto by 50p? I go, that's right. And he go, and if you buy the ticket, can you get this? I said, that's right. Because we'd get so much information out. All I could say, that's right. He'd ask the questions, give the information. I go, that's right. That's right. That's right, buddy. And as a result, that stuck to me. It just ran for 7 weeks, that commercial.
That's mad. Yeah, right, okay.
That's right.
And I guess that bond is there for life now with you two.
Yeah, well, I don't see John that much now, and he and me as well, because he lives out the other side of the county. We tour different schedules and everything else. But we meet up occasionally, yeah. And
remember the good times.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's right.
I mean, you've done so much. I recently watched Garage again, you know, Lenny Abrams, and this like incredibly deep, serious acting performance, you know, which I'm sure you're very proud of, and rightly so. And anyone who hasn't seen it, they should check out that film. It's fantastic. Did you really, like, enjoy that? There's a serious actor in you there as well, very much so, and you're clearly observing things that aren't just funny, but have a depth and a resonance as well.
Well, I always think any comic is an actor, you know what I mean? You'll find some of the best acting performances in movies and stuff. I have a film coming out in 2 weeks' time, and Tommy Tiernan is in it with me, and we're actually doing The Late Late in the next week or so, I think. I probably shouldn't have said that. You know, but like, Tommy's another example of a great actor as a comic, you know, and is
a deep person.
And very, very deep. And Dylan Moore, is again, I just did a film with him 2 weeks ago in Belfast, and, you know, it's a funny thing about comics, you do get pigeonholed until you end up with, for me, doing Garage was a huge change. I ended up working with John Boorman and some great directors and actors as a result of that.
Were you nervous about doing Garage?
Yeah, I was. As I said to Mark O'Halloran, who wrote it, I said, there's no script there. You know, it was, and I meant that in a funny kind of way. I remember in Cannes at a press conference saying that and getting but you see, there's a great script there, but for my character, there's a lot of non-dialogue. So, which meant performance, and meant a very, very strong performance to get across that, you know. And also, the character was challenging, and the type of character he was. But it was amazingly written, and it's like they say, the perfect storm. You know, Lenny Abrams, an amazing director, and Mark O'Halloran, an amazing writer, and great camera department and sound, everything. You know, you're the best in the business working on that. Yeah. And it worked out great.
Because it's amazing to watch that and then watch you on Father Ted in an I Shot JR t-shirt.
Yeah.
With your arse out.
Yeah, that was the first TV show I did.
Is that right?
Yeah. My dad watched that in Wales and he was mortified. I think when I dropped my pants, he says, would you leave me on, dog? That's me, fella. he wasn't happy with that at all. I think he was expecting the Shakespearean.
Jeez, that's another piece of genius as well, that show.
Oh, it was brilliant. It was great to work on that. And the funny thing about working on Father Ted, we shot that the first series up in Donabate and around, and then the second series moved down to the Hinch and down around Milltown Abbey and all around there. But the first series, like, it didn't get a huge reaction and got a lot of flack in the press and the media and everything. And it wasn't until the second series was out that it started getting traction. So when we made the first two, I didn't work on the third one. When we made the first two, there was no big buzz about it.
I don't remember that, actually. Is that
right? No, there wasn't. I remember making the second series and being delighted it was commissioned, you know, and thinking, this is great. But there wasn't the huge... That didn't happen until into the second one.
Why was that, do you reckon?
I don't know. I genuinely don't know. I just... Sometimes TV shows like that need... And that was fairly off the wall and of its time. They need time for the people to get into the characters and you know, to sit with it. And it was wacky writing. It's easy now to look at it and say, it's very funny. Back then, there was nothing like it.
Yeah.
And it was really kind of brilliant. It was genius, you know. So I remember my brother was working in England as a teacher, and he rang me one day and said, they've copped on to me. The students recognised me, you know, him, and he was getting fed on me on dog, did that to me non-stop. And he said, Pat, I think this is a huge hit, he said. It's like when the kids in the playground are quoting it.
Well, I was one of the kids in the playground. I was that age where, I mean, I didn't have Channel 4 back then.
Yeah.
And I remember hearing the buzz about it. And the first time I saw it, it was, whoa.
Yeah.
Did they show your arse?
No.
Right, okay. They show they Ted looking at your arse.
They couldn't afford that shot.
So, I mean... You get to observe it working. Is there a bit of ad-lib going on? Is there people saying, I think you should say it that way, or how did it all work?
Well, with Father Ted, the two, Graham and Arthur, were on set constantly, two writers. And no, there was no ad-lib, and it was all their writing. And they might change something on set, but it would all come from them. You know, both of them are geniuses.
So you're on tour again.
Yeah.
What's the plan now?
It's try and get to everywhere and finish in Kilkenny. on a high. You know, I'm starting a big tour. We're starting all over. It's going to be all over. Like, it's Olympia in Dublin in January, and we're back here in Limerick, and we're going to be all over the place. So it's
and when you say we?
Me and the crew and the guys.
Crew, yeah.
Yeah, me and
is that fun? Is that still something you really enjoy doing? Or?
Yeah. I mean, I've a lot of film projects next year, a lot more than I've ever had any time lining up, and some really good work. TV project working on next year as well, but the touring is always, it's the fun, like you getting out in front of a live audience, having the crack, it's hard to beat it.
And where do you test out the material?
I tend to take a small theatre when I'm putting a show together.
About this size, maybe?
No. No, up the country, and I go there for a week with a crew of guys, and we write and we work at it, and then we go to the pub and we work at it again. See if it's anyway funny and go back. And it's, you know, it's the, you put the stagecraft into it and everything else and work it out. So that's kind of how we do it. Once we get it up and running, then it just builds and builds and builds.
Great. Well, listen, the very best of luck with it. PatShort.com, I've been told, is where people can get tickets and come along and see it. Well, listen, thank you for being a fantastic, unexpected guest this evening. I'm sure everyone's very happy to see you. Pat Short,
thank
everyone.
Thank you. Steve, nice to meet you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Pat.
Thanks, Pat.
We're all off.
Hang out!
Keith, you're staying. We're getting straight into this. We've kept these people waiting long enough. We're sorry. So coming up, we are going to have our crappy quiz where one of you is going to win those pair of tickets to the 2019 Heineken Champions Cup home game of your choice. We are going to bring out Brian and Clive. There is a World Cup to talk about. And obviously, we have Scotland at the weekend as well. So we want the inside track on them. We have a Scottish Grand Slam winner, British and Irish Lions, 60 caps. Will you give a warm welcome, please, to Brian O'Driscoll, Clive Ward, and Craig Chalmers, everyone, as well.
I'm scooting back here.
Here, Joe.
Yeah, whatever. Jump in there, Clive. Go on, Chucky.
Thanks a million. Craig, thanks a million. You've been waiting patiently.
Eventually.
Finally.
Hopefully, saving the best for last.
Absolutely, so. Absolutely. Are you feeling confident?
No. listen, with Scotland, they're so inconsistent, especially over the last few years. They can be brilliant one weekend and dreadful the next. I'm hoping they're going to be obviously outstanding this Sunday against Ireland in the pouring rain in Tokyo, which I think will suit Ireland, to be fair. But listen, it's going to be interesting. I think the Irish forwards might overpower our forwards a little bit up front. A new kicking game with Sexton and Conor Murray is outstanding. So I think you've got the advantage there. But if it can just dry out for 80 minutes, we've got a chance, because I think we've got some really good rugby players in our side, and if we can get the ball to our key players like Hogg, Finn Russell, Seymour and Maitland, quality finishers there to score some tries.
To touch on your career for a second, Grand Slam winner, that's quite nice to be able to say.
Long time ago. 30 years next year. Wow. So I was only 12 at the time, so.
And it was England as well, that famous day.
Yeah, it was England at Murrayfield in 1990, so it was even more special to beat England. Because we'd scraped past Ireland in Dublin, as we normally did, would they? And
long before my time, when you actually didn't scrape past us, you beat us well in Dublin.
And then we beat France quite easily at home. They had the players sent off. Then went to Cardiff and beat Wales in Cardiff 39. And England had stuffed everybody that year. And they came to Murrayfield thinking it would just turn up and the Grand Slam was theirs, as they did for many years after that as well. And got a hiding, I think, in Dublin and in Cardiff and all over, which was great to watch. Sorry. Sorry, Clive. But they did win the World Cup, so, fair play. They went through the pain to get the glory. So it was a fantastic day for us. And unfortunately, it's been 30 years, just about 30 years, since we last won it. We did win the last Five Nations Championship in 1999. I was on the bench for every game. That's, but I picked up the win bonuses, though, so it was all good. So. But it was a great time for Scottish rugby with some great players and great characters. You know, Scott and Gavin Hastings, the Hastings sisters they call them, or more affectionately known as Scotland as Dumb and Dumber. And Gavin assures me Scott is dumber, and yeah, he could never understand how his sister had three brothers and he only had two. So that explains a lot. So, but I was blessed to play with. I think it's timing. You know, we've all had a bit of luck to get to where we've been, and we've worked hard. But I think the players that I came into the Scottish team with at that time, you know, John Jeffrey, Finlay Calder, Gary Armstrong, it was a great bunch of players. David Soule, our captain in 1990. Yeah. You know, it was a great time to play for Scotland, and we were reasonably successful. You know, and we were a match for most teams in the world at that point.
And I guess Gregor Townsend is one of the reasons you're on the bench all those years later.
Yeah, it was only one season. So he was better at centre, but he couldn't have the ball so much. He tried too much himself. But he was a great player, Gregor. And for me, he actually was great for me because I had, for quite a few years, I didn't have anybody really, you know, challenging me. And he came on the scene, and I think we shared, you know, we sort of had two seasons on. He played at fly half for a season. He was back to centre. And, you know, it was off and on, but, you know, with a great time playing with and against each other over the years, and some great victories. You know, unfortunately, I didn't play with him in the World Cup because he got injured in 1995 and didn't make the World Cup over there. So, it was great times for Scottish rugby. Pretty successful, and I think Gregor, as a coach now, is getting that back, and he's starting to get us back to where we were before.
And did you think he was going to be a coach when you played with him? Did you have that sense?
No chance. He was late for every meeting. Turned up with the wrong clothing on. You know, nowadays he's finding guys for doing that. So, you know, he was an instinctive player. He was one of these guys who I put outside him twice for Scotland in the centre. I think I got one pass in two games. So he just played his own game most of the time. But when he played it and he played flat, he was magnificent. But I much preferred it when he was playing at centre and giving the ball at the right times in the right place.
Because it was, if you want to call it a rivalry, it was billed as he was a bit of a maverick and you could control a game more so.
Yeah. He was loose, I was solid.
We'll preview that game in a couple of minutes. I mean, to take a broad look at the World Cup, Brian, this wouldn't usually be the type of environment where you'd bring up the spectre of doping, I suppose, but I think it behoves us to talk about it given the week that's been, whereby we've seen the South African press conference, it's been brought up in a big way. Brett Gosper, the CEO of World Rugby, has had to come out and defend the sport, not something you see every week. Really, it's on the back of Afue Gyanche's positive test in the last month or so. So he was World Rugby Breakthrough Player of the Year in 2018, like World Rugby Breakthrough Player of the Year, was destined to be a big star at this World Cup. A sample, a B sample show, he had three different banned substances, steroids, in his system. And then you couple that with, say, in May, Andre Stazen, 21 years old, South African, second row at Stade Francais, steroids again, positive test. Craven Week in South Africa has been talked about as well. So there's the where they are at the elite level, and then at schoolboy level, Craven Week being where the best talent gathers to effectively audition for top teams. They only did 122 tests, but they had six positives. So 1 in 20, 5% were positive. We're talking 17, 18-year-olds here. Last month, the high school coach in South Africa suspended after a former pupil alleged he had helped him to inject drugs to bulk up. And then John Mitchell, the England defence coach now, he said back in 2014, in South Africa, doping is an issue, and it starts at schoolboy level. The perception is you have to become big to be a professional. So you add all this up, and you lead with the Gyanche positive test, this breakthrough star, and what's happened this week, and you think of South Africa's place in the game. A lot of people's pre-tournament favourites. It's a massive cloud hanging over the game. We should address it. It's a cloud over this tournament, unfortunately, but it certainly is a big cloud.
Yeah, I think the positive test from Diante, you know, certainly set alarm bells off, because it's not kids, it's not Craven Week, it's not also-ran players, it's a guy that was a focal point of their team last year, Breakthrough Player of the Year on the international stage. So when someone that close to the World Cup squad, or who was clearly going to be a star of the World Cup, tests positive, I think it's not unreasonable, you know, for the world to kind of go, hang on, what's happening there? So is it an isolated incident? Are there more to come? Where is he getting, you know, his performance-enhancing drugs? So I think it's reasonable to ask all of those questions. You know, there was a picture posted of the South African rugby team during the week, and they're in phenomenal shape, and lots of teams will be in incredible shape. But what hangs with those sort of pictures is that positive drugs test. When people are looking phenomenal, immediately others put two and two together. Now, none of those players that were in that picture have tested positive. I'm sure they've passed a multitude of tests. I'm certainly not suggesting that any of them have doped. But the fact of the matter is, one of their teammates has. So that's what's created this cloud and brought it, you know, in two days out of a World Cup. And it's not the sort of thing that we want to be talking about. But in some ways, it's been brought upon themselves.
Mm. Keith, you look at that story, and it's a huge player that we're talking about here, and Brian, we, you know, talked about South Africa generally. I mean, again, without talking about individuals, it's hard not to look at South Africa and not have big misgivings. And I'm not just talking about South Africa here, but that's our starting point. But it's hard not to look at them at the moment and feel great about that situation, or not to have serious misgivings.
No, I think it becomes incumbent on World Rugby if because all the conversations that have happened in the last week have centred around South Africa, and if that's where some of the doubt is, you want a level playing field. You know, they will have to be squeaky clean in every way, shape, or form, and we've just seen in the last few months that they're not. Well, not that they're not, but one of their players is not. So the conversation that happened, I think a lot came out of it, that there isn't a systemic doping element. We would really hope that there isn't that, and that is obviously the wish. But now there's elements of doubt, and we've seen it in the past, that when there's elements of doubt, unfortunately, there often seems to be more that come out of the woodwork. And we just hope that that isn't the case, for the very simple reason you want it to be level for everybody. And you know, whether we'd, I think when you have a look at it, rugby is a game that has become very professional, very fitness oriented. The guys are getting an awful lot bigger. You're dead right, they're going to get bigger. The sports science, everything's better, the training's better. They're probably playing half the matches that we were maybe 15, 20 years ago, or pretty close to that. They're going to get an awful lot bigger. But everybody's cynical about sport anyway. That is the nature of it. And I think it's very hard when it comes up onto the world stage, because I think there is an element when it's at underage. You know, we know that from in Wales that there's been a kind of chunk of guys came through the RFU last year, and obviously with Sam. Yeah. And it's different, and that's a different conversation. But if it's going up onto the professional level, we just don't want it. We want to get it out of there as quickly as we can. So whatever steps World Rugby has to do to make certain that this doesn't become a trend, it has to happen.
We'll come back to schoolboy in a second. So if we take it broadly, there's three levels. Schoolboy, then there's those at senior level who are trying to make the elite level. And there's no doubt at that senior level it's happening in a big way. Like, if you look at UCAD figures over the last 10 years, they've had 66 rugby positive tests, which is more than second and third place combined. So that second tier of players, senior players trying to make it or whatever, it's definitely going on there. And then you have elite level. Clive, to stay with elite level, and Dianche as a jumping off point, or Andre Stazen, how big a problem do you think it is? It certainly is happening, but it's the extent that is the question mark.
I think the only thing that surprised me was the almost the lack of media coverage, because this positive test wasn't just happened last week.
It's about a month ago.
Almost, if that had been cyclist or a swimmer or an athlete in an Olympic, it would have been massive front page news.
Why do you think it wasn't?
I don't know. I think that's where rugby's got to be careful, because this wasn't just a sort of a junior player, your level three player. This is one of the superstar players, as I said, the breakthrough player. So to me, it was a huge story. I didn't get much coverage. But that was the only surprise to me. It's like all things, you know, you see it from Olympic sports. You can never invest or spend enough money in trying to control or kind of get the tests in place. But it's incredibly expensive when you're actually on the other side of things, to actually run these tests, to run a proper doping program on a worldwide basis for a sport like rugby, the World Cup coming up, is a lot of investment from all the basic unions. But I think, yeah, anyone would be quite naive to say this is not going on, because the temptations are there. Like it is in any power sports, and you've seen, you know, the problems Olympic sports have happened. So rugby's just got to just do everything humanly possible to have just zero tolerance to this situation. But it's an expensive process to put in place when you're trying to actually monitor these athletes on a worldwide basis.
Have you any sense how prevalent it is at the top level?
No, not at all. No, I hope it's just an isolated incident. But you when you see the numbers, it's not... I think we're kind of wrong to kind of highlight South Africa here. I think you find there's people having tested all around the world. It can happen. You know, it'd be very naive. You know, you can get this stuff online if you're really that inclined to do this. So I think it's wrong to actually pick on South Africa at this stage, especially with the World Cup coming up. They had the high-profile player tested positive, but I think it's a worldwide issue for the game of rugby.
Yeah. The thing is, Brian, it's impossible to put a percentage on it. Like I said, nobody here is naive. It's going on, it exists, like it does in all sports, most likely. It's hard to know the extent. Like, if you were just to go to by positive tests, Mike Earle, he's World Rugby's anti-doping manager, he said the average fail rate at elite level in the last 4 years is 0.4%, so less than 0.5%. But clearly, it's obviously, there's more going on.
Yeah, but it's obviously, I think it's far less prevalent at elite level because there is so much testing, and that the players know that. I think the area of concern is at the underage levels at 16, 17 years of age, and I don't know what it's like in the UK, but in Ireland we don't have testing at schoolboy level, which for me, I don't understand. Because that's where the real temptation is, that's where character...
Just on that, there was a competition down here in UL a couple of weeks ago, interprovincial, and there was testing for the schoolboys. Mm. They did test.
Ratified by who? So was that done internally, or?
I don't know, actually, but there was drug testing.
Well, just to clarify that one, because I did...
What age group was a matter of interest? Because under 18, but does that have to get parental sign-off, or what?
I'm not sure.
Well, I think that's great to hear. It is great to hear, because if I was a parent of a 15 or 16-year-old skinny kid that is being pressurized into, you know, or being told that they're not going to make it because they're not big enough and there's a temptation and there's something presents up, I would want my kid to be tested. I would want to discourage it. And I think they're going to have to come down with harsher bans as well, I think.
To stay with professionalism for 1 second, and then I absolutely do want to come to you, Craig, because I know a bit of personal understanding of it. How often would you have been tested back towards the end of your career, Brian?
Pretty regularly. It's hard to put a number on it, but you might go through a season of once or twice, but you might get done five or six times over the course of the season. You know, during pre-season, it was random. During matches, two numbers are picked. So, you know, from in the 23, so you could be sitting on the bench and you can be plucked out, and the opposite number, you know, so 13 in my position, the 13 for whoever you were playing against, you'd be sitting and sharing the, you know, seat in the medical room with them, making sure that the assistant was not letting you out of their sight. You know, most of the time they didn't really want you to go back into the dressing room. So it's, you know, there's no getting away from it. So when you've been selected, you're going to produce a sample. Or you're going to, you know, obviously you're going to have a failed test if you, for some reason, you vanish or you disappear, and it's happened in the past, you know, in other codes where, you know, players realise that I've heard, you know, going back to the 80s and 90s, you know, players, you know, see the drug testers coming to the training session and they go, I had a big weekend, I'll see you on Wednesday, and that has happened. That is far less, certainly not in rugby union, far less prevalent these days in the professional era, but it's the underage stuff for me is the concern, because I think that's where players can be manipulated, that's where players can make poor decisions, and they've got to come down harder on them and educate them that this are the repercussions if you take these substances.
The situation at the moment is testing on rugby players like senior professionals at the moment. In 2018, it's gone up 60% in 2 years, which is an amazing statistic. So the number one most tested sport in Ireland is 179 tests in cycling. Number two is now rugby, 178, up 60% in 2 years. And the Sport Ireland CEO, John Tracy, said, the graph speaks for itself in terms of where we see the risks. Like, you think about that statement now and where the game has gone in their eyes in the last 2 years. And of schoolboy rugby in Ireland, Sport Ireland said it's now considered a high-risk area. Again, this is really worrying language when you stop and think about it. Basically, the situation in schools is the IRFU are not the governing body of the school's competitions, so they can't conduct the tests. Parents would have to give consent. Sport Ireland have asked the IRFU to look at this. Interestingly, New Zealand 2017, because the New Zealand Union do run the competitions, they can test, they don't need parental control. So, look, I don't have a feel for what's going on in the schools, the Senior Cup, and it looks unbelievably competitive. But listening to you, Brian, it does sound like you'd have worries that there are the supplement culture we hear about, this is not an exaggeration.
I think with the financial gains to be made and career prospects enhanced, I think that always comes with temptation and the dangers of potential drug use and in any sport. And we're still relatively in our infancy in professional rugby. It's only 25 years since we changed from amateur status in 95, 96. So I think that is the danger age. And the realization as well is that if you do dope once, yes, you might pick up a two-year ban, but it's that maintenance. You won't ever lose what you've taken. So you might go off and, if you're a good trainer and you're fastidious in your preparation of post those 2 years, you can come back a much different athlete. So that's why I would be more inclined to look at longer bans and not make it as easy. You talk about the residency rule only being 3 years. Some players only getting a two-year ban to then go on and have a fruitful 10 or 12 year career where they mightn't have made it prior to taking any performance enhancing drug makes absolutely no sense to me. Yeah. So I would like to see either the schools taking control of it or the IRFU taking control of it, because I'm sure there is temptation. I don't know if there is, but I would imagine there is. And you hear Chinese whispers, but you don't know whether that's the case. If there's something there, I'm sure there's, I'm not saying it's littered throughout the schools, all schools or all counties or all provinces, but it's a conversation worth having and we need to push it a bit further.
Greg, thank you for waiting patiently. So we had you booked long before this thing all blew up, so don't think you're here because of your experience with it. But as a father, you got a phone call from your 19-year-old son at the time, training with the Under-20 Scotland, and it was not a call you wanted, I'm sure. In so much as you want, tell us about what happened.
But my story is, and you've touched on it really, really well, I had a son, Sam, who was 19. He was just on the edges of the Scotland Under-20 squad, and he was always told he wasn't big enough. And I said, listen, you just got to train hard, work hard. It's your genetics. You know, I was at your age, you're a lot bigger than I was at your age. And I said, try that jacket on. And it's my Lions blazer from the Lions tour when I was 20 years old. He couldn't get it over his shoulders. He was only, he was only 19. So listen, that's who I was. You worked hard in the weights and stuff, but he got a bit peer pressure. Two of his mates have been taking this supplement, and they gave Sam some of the pills to take. And he took for 5-6 days. Sam's a type 1 diabetic, and he had a bad reaction to it, so he stopped taking them. And then he got called up out of the blue to the Scotland Under-20s session. Sean Noreen called him up, come up. We're going to Ireland to play in Ireland. Come up, and then got up there that night. So my mum took him up to Murrayfield. And that night, randomly, 11 out of the 33 got tested, and he was one of them. And he was a bit weird he went across and played in the game. He thought that it might not show up because of his diabetes and stuff. you know, he didn't know what to think. And he was a bit weird. And I went to Australia to the Lions tour in 2013. I was in Dubai. I got a phone call. I was having dinner in Dubai on his mobile. You know, listen, I've been tested positive for a steroid. And that was when he told me that he'd taken this stuff. And, you know, he was going. And the big problem for me is WADA at the time just wanted to brush it and just give him a 2-year ban. He admitted it. He told them what he'd taken. And they just wanted to give him 2-year ban, not ask how he got it, where he got it, anything. And to me, that's a huge problem, because these kids need a little bit of aftercare. They're just kids. They're trying to get bigger. The coach had told them he wasn't big enough, because the game has changed so much. You've got to be big, a bit more bigger and more physical. So I pushed it and went to WADA and World Rugby, and Sam then became a sort of ambassador for the Under-20s World Cup over in New Zealand, and went and spoke to, he did a video for them, which was online, and got, you know, thousands and thousands of hits, which was pretty emotional. It was hard for him to do. It's getting better. But he went across there and did that, and total respect to him, but he was never the same person after he'd...
Was he not?
The 2-year ban, two years out of rugby, he did it for 5-6 days, but it was in his system. And then he went to this training session and got tested. Idiot, stupid, totally stupid. You know, I just wish he'd come and spoken to me about it.
Because I watched the video and you can tell he's an honest young person. Listen, like he feels terrible about it.
And the thing is, you know, I said, you know, listen, go and do this stuff. Will it help? The only way that anyone can get time off a ban is if they grass somebody else up. You can get up to 18 months off your 2 years, which Sam got, if you grass somebody else up, if you bring somebody else in. That's the only way. You can do all the good work at clubs and within the 20s in New Zealand, and you get no thanks for that. You just, you know, it's actually a good thing to do, because it does open a lot of guys' eyes. And hopefully if it's turned one or two guys off doing it, then it's been a success. But the only way you get any time off any of your bands is if you grass up anybody else that's doing it at the same time.
Where are you on the 2-year ban?
No, I think it should be more. I think it should be more. I agree with you.
To the point that it will discourage. Is that the sole purpose?
Well,
or
I just don't think that, you know, I think the game is, some of the best players are the guys that aren't the big bulky guys, you know, and, you know, I think you work hard, your body will get as big as it needs to get naturally if you work hard at it. And, you know, I think that Sam got 2 years. You know, nowadays, if you get caught with certain steroids in your system, it's a 4 years. And I think 4 years, maybe it should be 5, I don't know. I don't think it should be total ban, personally, because the thing is that somebody can spike something. I don't know, it can be difficult. Somebody could be in a bar one night and you could stick something in your drink. You don't know. But I think it's something that South Africa have had a massive problem over the years with it. I think there's been problems in Wales, as I think Woody touched on. But I think there's a lot more people at the lower level are doing it. And it's not just for rugby. It's for image, yeah, and look. You know, in this new age of mobile phones and all that kind of nonsense.
Yeah. Was that Sam done with rugby then?
Sam doesn't really play now. You know, he came back and then never really got back into it. And yeah, it's sad because he was a talented young player, but you know, you can't make him do something he doesn't want to do anymore. So yeah. I think it put him off. And yeah, listen, it's done. It's done. He's got to move on.
It's tough. When you watch, I appreciate what you're saying about the lower levels. When you watch this World Cup, for instance, will you be watching it with a very skeptical eye? How big a problem do you feel against?
No, I love the game, and you know, I think there's players out there that will take risks. But listen, these guys work very, very hard, and I'm not pointing the finger at anybody. So you know, I like to think that at the highest level, I don't really see how they can get away with it if they're getting tested regularly within the unions and by World Rugby. So I think it's happening it's a very small amount of it happening at the top level. Mm. And one or two are getting caught, but I think lower down the leagues, there's loads of it because they can't afford all the testing. I mean, as the boys said before, when I was coaching at Melrose, you know, we would know the drug testers were coming, so you'd be out in the pitch, and then they would pick a couple of guys who were at training that night, and we just, you know, we would say, you know, listen, has anyone been doing anything they shouldn't be doing at the weekend? And if you have, you know, disappear now because you may get tested. And I wasn't. None of our guys were in steroids. But they might have been
recreational.
You know, a recreational drug.
Yeah.
And I think recreational drugs, if you do get tested positive for one of them nowadays, the guys might be able to, you know, correct me on this. There is a warning system, I believe.
Yeah, I think the Premiership have a warning system for recreational.
Like three strikes and you're out or something, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Brian, just the last one on this, because I do appreciate there is a World Cup game people want to get your thoughts on. Your sense of the Irish professional game at the moment for people who have concerns? Four provinces, Irish international team, your sense of the picture in this country?
Yeah, listen, we're not without without failing ourselves. Like you look over the last 20 years, there's been two Irish internationals who failed drug tests that I certainly know of. So it's not a case of pointing fingers at other nations.
Sure.
We need to look at ourselves too. But I never saw anything in my 15-year playing career. And I don't know, maybe there's a naivety to that, but I really didn't. So if there is anything going on, it's very much being done privately. But
okay.
I don't think there is at the top level. And maybe I'm still naive to think at elite level. But to Craig's point, there's so much testing that I think they would be sifted out. And they have in cases in the past. Mm. You know, I won't have to mention names, but you know, prominent internationals. You know, had to picked up bands and appropriate bands. So it's one that's not going to go away.
Yeah.
It's not going to go away because with money and with career opportunity is going to come temptation.
Okay. Let's talk about the weekend. So Ireland against Scotland. There's meant to be a deluge. Does that play into Irish hands, Keith? That's what I'm reading. That's the consensus that Ireland's structured game plan against the free-flowing Scottish ambitions will be helped by the rain?
I don't think any team is ever helped by the rain. I hated playing in the rain. And, you know, you work on plans to play into pickpockets and to play in such a fashion and to target the opposition and to play certain moves that you know will work. Everything slows down. Everything, the movement of the ball, where you catch it at different times. It's going to be hot, and it still will be hot, even won't be as hot as it has been with that rain. It just makes it incredibly difficult. For me, I don't think it helps us. I think we are we're a team that has had the hex over Scotland for the last 5 or 6 years. I think we have a pretty strong squad at the moment. I think we'd be pretty confident to go out and perform very well. I think the rain brings everything an awful lot closer. Mm. It becomes very hard to take the ball into contact, to make certain that you hold on to it. Very hard to do anything wrap round, very hard to do anything really subtle. You can do it. And we mentioned one of the games earlier on, I think it was the second test in 2005 in the lashing rain. For the Lions, was that 2005 second or third test?
I've forgotten that.
And, anyway, it was the best performance I'd ever seen in dreadful conditions by New Zealand.
Yeah.
I can remember it as clearly now. Tano Manga going left, passing off his left hand, a 15-metre flat pass, was just something I hadn't seen before in the lashing rain.
Yeah.
So you can play and you can attack, and Scotland will want to attack. I think Scotland will try and attack anyway. I just think that's in their nature. It's in Gregor's nature. Gregor's training session, I had a lovely conversation with him during the year. He said, Woody, you'd love the training sessions. I just throw the ball up in the air and I set the guys after it. It's carnage. He said, there's guys knocking each other all over the place. He said, you'd love that. No, I said, admittedly. And he said, but there's no structure. No structure whatsoever. So I think structure could kind of crumble a little. I don't think it's, you know, but...
Yeah. Clive, can you give us the outside perspective on Ireland? Because One of the lines that's been talked about here ad nauseum over 2019 is, have we become predictable? When you look at Ireland, what have you seen this year? We know about 2018. What's been your read on what's gone a bit wrong by the high standards this year?
Yeah, I think the most interesting game was the England game in Dublin, the first Six Nations game, where I don't think until now they've quite kind of recovered that. I think it was such a shock to the system. It was such a shock to the coach, because they didn't only get beat by England, they got battered by England. And England just played the game faster than them. I think the whole tone was set from the first long line out to Alangi over the top, and they eventually scored within 3 or 4 minutes. And I just think that's such a big shock to the system, because they'd beaten the All Blacks. Everything was on plan. And I think that's through the system now. And I've got a feeling they're going to go well. It's not because I'm sitting in Limerick, but I think we look at their team when he actually is now in the World Cup mode, and it's all, the great thing about World Cups, everyone arrives at the same time, meaning everyone's peaking for this one moment in time. There's no excuses. Everyone's kind of got it to here. So the warm-up matches were irrelevant to me. But I just think looking to the side, if Sexton is fully fit, fully firing, I think they'll have a good World Cup. And I agree with Keith. I think that it's easy to kind of characterise that the rain will suit Ireland. I think it's a leveller. And I think Ireland are ahead on the team sheet, so I think Ireland got a better side, just. And they sort of level it a little bit, which I think will kind of just get almost hopefully the best out of Ireland. They've got to go out and play. So I think Ireland will win at the weekend, and it's a huge game for both sides, because the next big game, one of them's got to play Japan, having lost that first game, and then you're under huge, huge pressure. But when you look at the game, Ryan and these fellas, they've got some good, good players there. So I'm confident Ireland are going to have a good World Cup.
Brian, on the injury situation, we'll come to the back three in a minute. So Henshaw out, Ringrose in. You're the perfect man to ask. I've seen a lot of people say, well, Ringrose's form is off. And the other thing that's been said is he hasn't developed as a playmaker enough. Is that all fair?
Yeah, I think when the game's not going for him, I think he could have gone and taken a bit more ownership of it and looked for the ball a bit more. I think it's been slim pickings with regards to the quality of possession that he might have gotten in 2018, and it's a lot easier to play with front football and when the team's going forward. When you're living off scraps, it's harder to make a difference, and he's definitely a game breaker and a game changer, but it's difficult to do that on the back foot in traffic when you're not getting what you've been used to. So it's not a shock to hear that Aki and Henshaw, after their performance at the weekend, last weekend, were touted as the centre pairing. I think it's fair enough. I think he's been given a lot of goes and it hasn't quite clicked for him. So, maybe a little bit of time out on the bench will serve him well. I think what might be interesting with the weather this weekend, and I know coaches don't pick their team based on the weather, but with one eye on heavy rainfall, and I agree with Craig, I think it suits Ireland a little bit more because of their forward pack. I think we've got a better forward pack than Scotland. I think the firepower in Scotland's backs is pretty impressive. They've got some great broken field runners, but I don't think they're going to get as much opportunity if they don't get that service from their forward, which I think Ireland can deny, and particularly in wet conditions. But I wonder the makeup of some of those. So the back row, do you go with a groundhog now? Absolutely, particularly against the likes of Hamish Watson. So does Josh van der Fleer definitely start? He does for me. Do you potentially pick two other big ball carriers in Stander and Conan at 6 and 8 that work quite well against Wales? And then likewise out in the centre, do you go with an alternative to Gary Ringrose and play Chris Farrell, who's going to get you advantage line? Because the game becomes a lot more simplified when the rain comes down. So it's really just about playing percentages, about playing keep ball, and Ireland are particularly good at that. So I think that comes into play. Maybe some selections on a Monday that Joe was looking at. And he's definitely someone that looks at the conditions. He knows exactly what's happening. Does it tweak and make modifications to his game on the basis of what's coming.
And his hand's going to be forced a bit in the back three. So Rob Kearney and now it seems Keith Earls as well are in a race against time. So suddenly you're, okay, Stockdale's on one wing and then Conway and Larmour are the two obvious options everyone's discussing. Who goes full back of Larmour and Conway and why?
I don't know. I don't know. I think I'd probably go with Conway at full back personally. I just feel a little bit more secure with him there. His aerial skills are better than Larmour's. Kicking game, probably a fraction better than Larmer's as well. Don't see him falling off too many tackles. I don't think he possesses the same counter-attacking ability, albeit he's a threat. But I think I'd be looking for the more solid all-round performer, which Conway has morphed himself into being. You know, from the days of being in the Leinster Academy of this guy with insane footwork.
He was a superstar kid, wasn't he, in school?
Yeah, well, he came out of school when he was still in school. We were training for the Heineken Cup final in 2009. And himself and Brendan Macken had just won the Senior Cup of Black Rock, and they came to make up numbers. We were short numbers, and they shredded us the week of the Heineken Cup final.
Right.
We thought, if a couple of 18-year-olds are going to do this to us, what are Leicester going to do to us? So we couldn't wait to get them into the squad, and he had this majestic footwork. Anytime you did footwork drills with him, it was a bit like Jason Robinson. You just picked a side and you know, fancied your chances on a two-way bet.
Yeah.
But he's very much modified his game into being Mr. Reliable, and I think that's what Joe really likes in him, and that's why he couldn't leave him out of his squad. So all that said, I think if Rob Kearney and Keith Earls are injured, or even if Rob Kearney's injured, I think he might go with Andrew Conway.
Mm. Craig, Finn Russell, are you a fan of him? Are you a fan of what Gregor's doing with this team? And, you know, he said, I want to play the fastest tempo rugby, which has been a stick there in world rugby, the fastest tempo game in world rugby, which has been a stick that they've been beaten with ever since.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be hard to do that in the conditions on Sunday. But I do believe they'll still try and play with a bit of width and try and move Ireland about a bit. That's the one area, you know, we talked about, you know, the power up front that Ireland have. The Irish pack is much more powerful than the Scottish guys, bigger ball carriers. I think the one player that we're going to miss is Sam Skinner. He's the one guy that's been injured that can't make Japan. He's coming to the team the last year and a half and made a big impression. And he's maybe a player who'd have played in that back row, giving us that extra bulk and ball carrying ability. But I think the line-out is somewhere. Ireland's line-out has been pretty poor in the lead-up to the World Cup. I think that's one area that Scotland will target big style on Sunday.
I suspect we're going to have to get used to hearing that.
No, it is, but it you know, I think you've lost your big fella, David Toner. He's not going. From what I can gather, he's the line-out caller, you know, and they've brought the South African guy in who's had one cap or whatever. So for me, you know, that's an area that we've got to target.
Yeah.
We've got to deprive Ireland of the ball. Ireland got one of the best tactical kicking games in the world with O'Shea and Sexton. And when they're getting that right, you know, Stuart Hogg, fantastic going forward in a dry pitch, but he does not like those high balls. You know, a bit like Serge Blanco back in the day. You know, he won't like them. And our back three are great in attacking mode. But defensively under the eyeballs, we're going to get peppered all day long, I think.
Yeah.
And Ireland will play the percentages far better than Scotland. That's one thing that Finn Russell has, you know, got better at over the last couple of years. I think he was very, very loose. Everything had to go, and it was interceptions, missed touch kicks.
Yeah.
His control of a game is far better now than it ever was. And I think going to France, I actually worried about him going to France. To Racing, I thought he may be homesick and heard Simon Z was a bit loose, so I thought he might lead him astray. But he seems to be doing quite well. I think he's their best mates and he's doing well over there.
Yeah.
And I think he's grown up as a person. I think Finn growing up as a person has made him a better player.
Yeah.
And I'm just hoping that he is one of the big stars of this World Cup, because I think he's got the talent, and you've all seen it. But it's just got to do it in the big games and at the right time, right place,
yeah.
And starting Sunday morning, hopefully.
Clive, a word on England. They're looking very good at the moment in many ways. The likes of Tuilagi and Billy Vunipola coming back this year made a big difference. Where was Eddie Jones last year? Like, what was going wrong? What was off with them, and why has it changed, do you suspect, this year?
Well, obviously, England-Tonga is the big game this weekend that everyone's tuning in for. You can, hindsight's a great thing. I generally believe, you know, when I saw the team sheet that played against Ireland in early February in the first game of the Six Nations. When you suddenly saw your Maras there, both Vinopolos were playing, Manu Tuilagi's back. You know, it's amazing how good a coach you become if you've got a full strength team.
Yeah.
You know, and suddenly he had all these players back. And I think, you know, to me, and I was with Sky during the game against Ireland in August in the warm up game, they just looked physically strong. And I think having these two young lads on the flank in Curry and Underhill, I hope he does stick to that. I really, you know, there's talk. You know, some of the other guys are saying, we've got to put a bigger guy at six. I thought these guys were fantastic. You know, so he's just suddenly, everyone's just fit again. You know, Tuilagi's been out for ages, and suddenly there's this team. But the big thing, you know, I've met with Eddie a couple of times. I've got him as a friend. And, you know, we competed big time against each other. But I like him a lot. The big thing, all I keep saying to him, and I think you can have as much power as you want, but if you play slowly, you're not going to win. You know, if England can play quickly, and this is what you saw against Ireland in August, where on a beautiful day, sun shining, they played so quick with all these power runners. It was, and, you know, and suddenly the forward pack, especially with Underhill and Curry playing, the offload and just the little passes, bang, bang, bang. It's hard to stop any team in the world. And that's why England got a chance suddenly, because they've got a very fit, powerful team. They're one of the fittest teams in the competition. But they're playing quicker. They're just playing quicker, quicker, quicker than they have been in the past.
Yeah.
And I hope that's going to see them through. I think they've got a real chance. I mean, their draw is... I mean, if England were to sort of get out on top of this, they're going to have an amazing run of victories, because they've got a, you know, it's going to be Argentina, France. Then they'll play Australia or Wales in the quarterfinals. Then they will play South Africa, the All Blacks in the semi-finals. So to win it, they're going to do it tough.
Yeah.
But I think they've got a team, as long as they play quick.
The reason I asked about Jones, did I read you had a chat with him, friendly chat, where you said you felt he'd become a bit distracted last year?
No, you keep reading things about me that aren't true. So.
It was after the Scotland game, and he turned up in Manchester. That time him and a fan got into a back and forth.
Yeah. I did have a bit of going about that. I mean, it's good banter, really. It was interesting. So they go to Scotland, and I was just, because I'm, you can put yourself in the coach's position. So you go and play the Scots up in Murrayfield, and it's a late kickoff. It's like a 5 o'clock kickoff or something. And then next day he gets into trouble with some Scottish fans or someone.
Yeah.
He's traveling to Manchester, and I'm just working. What are you doing at a railway station, half past eight on a Sunday morning? Because you know, from a coach's point of view, you've got a lot to do on that day. And he was going down to see Chelsea play Man United. Alex Ferguson invited him down, so we'd done that. Now, I just said, well, you know, obviously he thought he was going to beat Scotland and he can move away and do all this stuff. And I'm just going, you've got to be really careful here. And I think he just got distracted. And he shouldn't, you can't do that. I just don't think you can do that. Mm. The team will pick it up. Mm. So you get beat by the Scots fair and square. They got thumped in Scotland. That was a day where you got to circle the wagons, get everyone in on Sunday morning, have a good chat, be there for the medical stuff, do the press, do the media. And he's gone walkabout. So... You know, I think he got that wrong, but you know, I'm a big fan of his. I think he's done a great job for England. I think he's, you know, he's often said to me, because you know, he was the opposition coach in 2003, and I can totally relate to this. He says there's not a day goes past ever since 2003, he thinks about that moment every single day, and it's driven him on, you know. And he said, I can remember the seat I was in, I can remember you coming across and shaking hands. He said Wilkinson, the whole thing. Every single day. Now, he's got a chance of redeeming. You don't often get a second chance. And he's got a chance of going with a very good England team and doing something special. So all these coaches are amazing, talented, they're driven, but he's seriously driven to get this team over the line. And I think also his Japanese background, Japanese roots, coach Japan, will be a big advantage out there. There's no doubt about that. I think it'll help a lot when you're used to the country, the language, the whole thing. And obviously wish him well.
We've got to wrap things up. Who do you think is going to win the World Cup?
Me? England, there's no doubt about it. England are going to win the World Cup. So.
It was going so well this evening.
It's going so well to be back home in Limerick. I think both New Zealand and South Africa will make the semi-finals, and I think it's who kind of gets up there with them. It's going to be tough for Scotland and Ireland because they've got to get past New Zealand or South Africa, and both teams arrived. When I saw that South African team today, I think South Africa, I think the birth, It won't be such a shock to me. I think South Africa will roll New Zealand at the weekend. I think that will be an amazing start to the tournament. So I think South Africa, when I saw the team today, I think they've got every chance of winning on Saturday, getting New Zealand first up. So it's just the way the whole draw goes. But England have got to... I just like the team at the moment. And if they can keep 15 players on the field to play, they're a tough, aggressive team. If they play quick, they've got every chance of going all the way.
Keith?
Yeah, I think England have a good chance. For me, it still is New Zealand, South Africa. I'd like it to be us. I think we have not the hardest group, and not taking anything for granted. And we have an abominable quarterfinal. We're going to be at our absolute best if we have all our players fresh, fit, focused at that stage. I would hope we could go past it, but we've never done it before. And traditionally, the big teams turn up in the semi-finals and the final, and they have done consistently. So to try and go, obviously, hard, we'll go hard. We want Ireland to do it. But when you're looking at it, I think it's really tough for us. And I think we could lose a quarter-final playing as well as we can play. But we could also win a quarter-final playing as well as we could play. And I would hold out hope for the fact that Joe and his group of coaches and the players have done some pretty extraordinary things over the last few years. And the idea of a player going, and every player that goes there has to say, this is our chance, this is what we want to do, this is what we've done the last 4 or 5 years for us to actually get to this spot. So I don't doubt that Joe and the players think that they can go all the way. And whether it needs us to be kind of fully behind them and being cheerleaders for them or not, I don't know. But I think it's very tough for us. We have that as capacity, but I think the odds would be on other people.
Mm. Ryan, who's going to win it, and what about Ireland?
I think I probably agree with Clive in his summation with England are just teeing themselves up brilliantly. That you look at the players he mentioned that came back against Ireland, you know, anytime you see Manu Tuilagi in a team and fit and strong, I've played with and against him, and he's unplayable at his best. So you have that ball carrier, but also the skills of Owen Farrell and Ford to come off the bench, plus their firepower. I just think if they have a run of form with not picking up injuries to the Vunipola brothers, I think they will be very, very hard to stop. I hope he's right in that South Africa beat New Zealand and Ireland might top their pool, because I genuinely feel as though the better route for Ireland might be the All Blacks. And it seems crazy to actually say something like that, because we don't want to lose the run of ourselves. We've only beaten them twice in our history, but it has happened recently. But it's more the negative on playing South Africa. England showed the route and the prototype of how to beat Ireland with their power game, and South Africa have that in abundance. And if they play that game against us, I just don't know if we are able to cope with it, and that's my concern.
Is it really that simple?
It's just a ferocious intensity and simple size issue. I think you look at the ball carriers of Vetsabet, Vermeulen, you know, the Elande in the centre, like Willy Leroux is probably their smallest player. Well, Cheslin Kolbe, you're talking about the smallest players, but then one of the most elusive. I just think the balance to their team and the strength of their pack would worry me. So the mystique hasn't gone from the All Blacks, because again, we've only beaten them twice, but it's the first World Cup we're going to where we've beaten every team in that World Cup. So we won't be afraid of anyone. And I just don't know if this New Zealand team is close to previous years. So I wouldn't be afraid of getting them in a quarter final. Our best against their best, I think we'll run them close.
Okay. Craig, if Scotland don't win,
well, I think we'll be in the final, probably against Ireland. So, you know, that'd be nice, wouldn't it? Yeah, I would take that. Listen, our group's tough. I think the first game for us is massive. It's a game that you guys expect to win and should win, but it's one we can win. And I think if we can get a win on Sunday against you guys, I think it'll give our boys a massive boost for the rest of the tournament. We've got our games run quite well, and then we play Japan, our last game in the pool. It doesn't really matter who you get in the quarterfinal, because it's South Africa or New Zealand. Get through that, the tournament's been a massive success. Scotland have done quite well, relatively well, in World Cups over the years, robbed in a couple of occasions that I've been involved in. And Gavin missed that kick as well in 1991.
How has this turned into 1991?
I know, it never leaves me. It's always there. You should have given it to me. But England, if they're all fit and healthy, I think will be very hard to beat, unfortunately.
Is that three Englands? Is that three Englands? You're England. Are you England, Brian?
No, I've not said that. I've not said they're going to win it yet. They're going to be hard to beat. I like looking at South Africa. I think, you know, they do look strong and powerful. I don't think they've got the skill in the backs. They've got some pace in the backs and power. But have they got the ability to break down defences at key moments? The team that can do that is the All Blacks. And I think if the All Blacks get good conditions to play in, on the day, I think they are the best team when they put it all together. And there'll be one or two upsets throughout the tournament, sure. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Hopefully starting on Sunday.
Before we go, by the way, I just want to mention, and you've been brilliant to hang on, I appreciate it. Before we go, we have another very special roadshow coming up. This is with thanks to Heineken. We're going to be at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre in Dublin, October 15th, if you're available. Michael Lynn is going to be there, Brian O'Driscoll, Keith Wood, Paul Howard's going to be the unexpected guest, and we'll have another very special guest as well. We can't keep calling it the unexpected guest when everybody's expecting them, but anyway, there we are. Paul Howard's going to be there, and we've got another very special guest that we're going to reveal in the coming days. Tickets are available now, offtheball.com/events is where you'll get them. Thanks to Heineken for making this happen. Thanks to you guys, brilliant audience, and can you give a round of applause to all of our guests as well. That's us done. Thanks so much, everyone. Thank you.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.